This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with author, scholar, and filmmaker Sal Landau about his article and film on the Cuban Five. The case of the Cuban Five, more than anything, defines the hypocrisy of the United States in its war on terror. We'll also hear the voices from Occupied Wall Street, lawyers, activists, unionists, why they're there and what they want. They call themselves the 99%, and they've ignited a mass struggle not only in New York, but across the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
There was an extraordinary interview with Dean Christopher Exley, the head of the University of California Law School. It's called Bolt Hall, one of the most prestigious law schools in America. And he was on the transition team, the Obama transition team, participated in a panel discussion about the transition team. Somebody asked him, was there any discussion about prosecuting the torturers in the Bush regime? He said, yes. He said, we did have that discussion about whether to prosecute the people that were responsible for torture. And in the end, we decided not to recommend it. Why? Because he thought that if they recommended prosecuting these people, that the CIA and others would institute, and this is his word, the CIA and others would institute a coup. Now, coup is a word that Daniel Ellsberg used several years ago in commenting on the consolidation of executive power under Bush and Cheney. It all started, you know, with 9/11 and the order for the use of military force, which declared war not on another country, but on a tactic and an idea. And then with military order number one, they suspended habeas corpus. Anybody, including an American citizen, could be put away forever without seeing a judge. The Center for Constitutional Rights fought that, but it's still a major problem. The Patriot Act was passed, which unleashed the police apparatus on all of our records. Now they know pretty much about us from everywhere. It made it possible to use outfits like Blackwater, private military in the United States, to use the National Guard from one state in another state without getting permission from the governors of either state. They totally militarized the local city police forces, as you can see from the conduct and equipment that the police have now, Pittsburgh and most recently in New York City. All of this added up with something that Ellsberg called a coup. Well, the latest development is something I want to discuss with you, and that's the assassination. An assassination is another word for murder, but an assassination is a political murder. And I want to talk about the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki. You'll remember he's the Muslim cleric defined by the media and the government, and there's not sufficient proof as far as I know of it, but they call him the radical cleric. And he was assassinated by the Obama machine, or allegedly assassinated. There now seems to be some question, but in any case, I believe he was assassinated. He's an American citizen, along with another American citizen and five Yemenis in the country of Yemen, a country with which the United States is not at war. And this is an extension, I think, of if you can pick somebody up and put them away forever. Now the executive in this, what Ellsberg called a coup, is saying that they can assassinate American citizens if they believe that these people are a threat. Well, let me read to you what Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, our co-host, wrote about this assassination. He wrote about it in The Guardian online. Michael wrote the following. Is this the world we want, where the President of the United States can place an American citizen, or anyone else for that matter, living outside a war zone on a targeted assassination list and then have him murdered by a drone strike? This was the very result we at the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU feared when we brought a case in the U.S. federal court on behalf of Anwar al-Awlaki's father, hoping to prevent this targeted killing. We lost the case on procedural grounds, but the judge considered the implications of the practice of raising serious questions, and the judge asked, quote, Can the executive order the assassination of a U.S. citizen without first affording him any form of judicial process whatsoever, based on the mere assertion that he is a dangerous member of a terrorist organization? End quote. Yes, Anwar al-Awlaki was a radical Muslim cleric. Yes, his language and speeches were incendiary. He may even have engaged in plots against the United States. But we do not know that because he was never indicted for a crime. This profile should not have made him a target for a killing without due process and without any effort to capture, arrest, and try him. The U.S. government knew his location for purposes of a drone strike, so why was no effort made to arrest him in Yemen, a country that apparently was allied in the U.S. effort to track him down? There are, or there were, laws about the circumstances in which deadly force can be used, including against those who are bent on causing harm to the United States. Outside of a war zone, as al-Awlaki was, lethal force can only be employed in the narrowest and most extraordinary circumstances, when there is a concrete, specific, and imminent threat of an attack. And even then, deadly force must be the last resort. The claim after the fact by President Obama that al-Awlaki's operationally directed efforts to attack the United States was never presented to a court before he was placed on a kill list. And that claim is untested. Even if President Obama's claim has some validity, unless al-Awlaki's alleged terrorist actions were imminent, and unless deadly force employed as a last resort, this killing constitutes murder. We know the government makes mistakes, lots of them, in giving people a, quote, terrorist label. Hundreds of men were wrongfully detained at Guantanamo. Should this same government or any government be allowed to order people's killing without due process? The dire implications of this killing should not be lost on any of us. There appears to be no limit to the president's power to kill anywhere in the world, even if it involves killing a citizen of his own country. Today it's in Yemen. Tomorrow it could be in the United States. Thank you, Michael Ratner. Coming back here to New York City, we're broadcasting really in the shadows of this magnificent encampment called Occupy Wall Street. Well, the police last Sunday, on October 2nd, arrested 700 of the occupiers as they were crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. And I want to read to you a statement from Margaret Ratner Kunstler. Margaret is the author, along with Michael Ratner, of the just-published book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, a book that everybody should have and look at because it'll tell you what your rights are. This is what Margaret Ratner Kunstler wrote about the arrest of the 700. She's an attorney and co-author of Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st America. And she said today, the mass arrests of 700 marchers coming from Occupy Wall Street was utterly illegal and part of a larger program by the state to shut down the most effective means people have of making fundamental changes. It was illegal because almost none of those arrested were warned that the arrest might ensue unless they left the bridge. Those arrests should be seen for what they are, a shot over the bow to any and all who would take to the streets. The protests can only go so far. Margaret went on to say that the powers that be, Wall Street and its friends, fear that because of the dire economic circumstances in this country, people will take to the street as they did in the Arab Spring. We saw similar police activity in 2004 in New York, where 400 people were netted and illegally held in custody for days. We saw how the protests in Pittsburgh at the G20 protests resulted in arrest after arrest. And we saw the Seattle World Trade Organization protests, where police violence was the order of the day. The biggest, greatest fear of the establishment is that people will take to the streets. The message we must send out to them is, yes, we will. Thank you, Margaret Ratner Kunstler. Attorney Mara Verhaelen-Hilliard, the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice, which is representing the protesters who were arrested on the bridge, issued the following statement in conjunction with the lawsuit that she filed against the New York City Police Department. We believe the NYPD engaged in a premeditated, planned, scripted, and calculated effort to get the protesters off the streets. The class action lawsuit, which Mara filed, says that these police tactics have been ruled illegal in other cases. It seeks to ban similar measures in the future. It also demands that the arrests be expunged and requests unspecified damages. The occupation of Wall Street, the encampment they've set up, has generated such thrilling energy that you can't even describe how fantastic it is. The organizers of this have brought in the various movements for social change as well as the union movement. The thing is expanding not only in New York City but around the country, from Boston out to California. You can get a live stream at Occupy Wall Street, stoccupywallstreet.com. Check it out for yourself. The way we're going to get this movement rolling is to build this thing all around the country. You can do it. We're in total support of it. And you'll hear more of the voices from the protest that our producer Jeff Brady and Heidi Boghossian from the National Lawyers Guild got just yesterday when they went down there and chatted with the demonstrators. We welcome back internationally known scholar and filmmaker Saul Landau. We talk with Saul about his recent article, A Judge Grants Dubious Probation, and his recent film, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up? In his article, Saul writes about the release of Cuban Five member Rene Gonzalez, who got out of prison on October 7th. He's now on parole in dangerous Miami for 3 years. The judge refused to allow him to go home. Miami isn't a good place for an admitted Cuban agent, Saul writes, because Gonzalez is one of the people that infiltrated the counter-revolutionary group Brothers to the Rescue, which had been committing terrorist acts against people and property on the island. Earlier this year, Gonzalez had asked the court to allow him to return to Cuba, where his family lives. As many listeners may remember, the Cuban Five are five Cuban men now serving lengthy prison sentences in some of the worst prisons in the United States, having been wrongfully convicted of conspiring to commit espionage sometime in the future against the United States. Saul Landau, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me, Michael.
And congratulations. We're talking to you from Vancouver, where your wonderful film, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up, is entered in the Vancouver Film Festival. What I want to know is why the sarcastic title?
Well, if people have been watching the classification for terrorists, you will find, I think, that they fall into three categories: the good, the bad, and the crazy. The good terrorists, of course, are freedom fighters, and they're the people who you find still walking the streets of Miami because they've directed their violence against Cuba, who is a bad guy, and so they're freedom fighters. Then there are the bad terrorists, and of course, they're all Muslims. They hate not only the United States, but the West and all good things. And then there are the other terrorists who are neither good or bad, simply crazy, like the guys who did the Oklahoma bombing or the Norwegian fellow who just did this massacre. And so, you know, we're essentially saying, well, okay, who is the real terrorist? And in the movie, I think we find out.
Well, let's talk about that, because they are walking the streets of Miami. The violence directed against Cuba since the 1959 Cuban Revolution is largely an untold story here in the United States. And that's, I think, one of the great things about your film, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up, is that you tell part of that story. What were you trying to get out to people?
Well, I mean, the idea is that people don't know what the Cuban Revolution was, and they don't know much about U.S. policy. And in the beginning of the film, I think we make that apparent when people are asked, you know, do you know who the Cuban Five are, referring to these five Cuban agents who were anti-terrorists and trying to stop terrorism, and today find themselves serving long sentences in federal penitentiaries. So we're trying to essentially enlighten people as to part of their history. Ironically, Cuba is now showing this film in their high schools, having found out that their students are also ignorant about their own history, just as Americans are. And so, the point here is to try to educate people through film. Obviously, we can only tell a small part of the story and show it with pictures. So we selected several events and try to provide a context so people would understand why the Cuban Five came to the United States and what their history was, that is, those people who preceded them. Cuba had very little recourse against terrorism over the decades other than to infiltrate the groups that were planning violence against Cuba and try, therefore, to impede their terrorist actions.
Why did they not just go to the American police, FBI, say, and say, look, these people are launching illegal attacks against people and property in Cuba. Help us. Why couldn't they do that?
Well, they did do that. And essentially, that got them into trouble. They gave the FBI enormous amounts of documentation, believing that the United States was serious about waging this war against terrorism. And even if Clinton was serious, he certainly didn't convey that or convey it successfully to his police authorities, that is the FBI, in Miami, or what you know is now known among insiders as the Autonomous Republic of Miami.
You can't get a fair trial in Miami. The Cuban Five who were in Miami trying to protect their own people from these terrorist attacks were themselves picked up, tried, and convicted for conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future. Tell that story, Saul.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. They had as much chance of getting a fair trial in Miami as a Jew would have had in Berlin in 1938. The amazing thing is the prosecution showed no evidence that there was any espionage. All they showed was that these guys talked to each other and that they were indeed looking for information. Well, of course they were looking for information, but the information was not on the strategic aims of the United States government or atomic secrets or any of that kind of stuff. What they were looking for was information that would help them stop bombings in Cuba. They were spying on Cuban exile groups that were based in South Florida. And the charges were ridiculous. Another charge against Gerardo Hernandez, who was the controller of the group, was that he aided and abetted murder, which means that he knew exactly the time of the flights of Brothers to the Rescue on February 24th, 1996, which the Cubans had warned them not to do, told the United States government and told Brothers to the Rescue, if you do this, you're going to get shot down.
Well, because the Brothers of the Rescue were flying over Havana, the capital, and dropping leaflets. Can you imagine what would happen to an airplane that flew over the White House and was dropping leaflets? It'd be vaporized.
Well, that's exactly what Fidel Castro says in the film.
That's right.
If indeed the shootdown did occur over Cuban airspace, as the Cubans insist it did, then there was no crime.
That's right.
And the United States government has refused to supply the defense, that is the Cuban Five's lawyers, with the NSA document that shows the exact space where the collision between the missile and the airplane occurred. And they say it's national security. And, of course, you know, that biblical phrase covers everything.
Well, that's ridiculous for something that
happened.
You mean
it's not in the Bible, somebody said?
15 years ago is no longer national security. But let's back up for a second, because the Cubans in Miami, the counter-revolutionaries who are trying to restore themselves and capitalism to Cuba, were actually targeting the Cuban tourist industry. Talk about that.
Well, when the Soviet Union went away in 1991, Cuba had very little recourse in terms of economic survival other than tourism. And as she began to get her tourist industry revved up, so too did the Cuban exiles in Miami start to level their guns at preventing tourists from going, in other words, or deterring tourists from going. And the best way to deter a Canadian or a European vacationer from enjoying the Cuban warmth and the warm water in the winter months is to explode a few bombs around the tourist hotels, and that's exactly what they did.
They killed an Italian tourist.
Well, the organizer of this was Luis Posada Carriles, and he hired a bunch of Salvadorans, one of whom we interview in the film. I call him, you know, my poster boy for moral schlemiel of the world.
Well, he's one of the fellas that's walking around Miami.
Yes, Posada, and we have some interviews with him in the film as well. And, of course, he denies that he did any of the stuff that he admitted to the New York Times that he had done. And he admitted it to the New York Times because he wanted people to read the story so that they wouldn't go to Cuba.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's wonderful. He gets honored, and he even got the keys to the city of Hialeah for doing things that he denies he has done. And if he hasn't done all those things, like knocking down a civilian aircraft, trying to assassinate Fidel on numerous occasions, and setting off a whole series of bombs, or orchestrating these bombings, if he hasn't done any of those things, well, why would they honor him? So it's quite perplexing, and it's also perplexing that no reporter asks the city of Hialeah's mayor or their council, what exactly did he do to earn the keys to the city?
We're speaking with Saul Landau, the filmmaker who's done a very fine film that I recommend. I've seen it. It's excellent. It's called Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? Saul, you alluded to the bombing of a civilian airline. It's now, this week is the 35th anniversary of that massacre. Tell us about that.
Well, this was a plot that was hatched by Luis Posada Carriles and his cohort, Orlando Bosch. They hatched the plot in Caracas, Venezuela. There were flights at that time by Cubana Airlines between Caracas and Havana. And the plane stopped at Trinidad and Barbados on the way. Posada and Bosch hired two Venezuelans to plant bombs in the airplane bathroom, which would go off at some time after the two bombers left the plane. And shortly after the plane took off from Barbados, one of the bombs blew up in the bathroom of the plane, blowing a hole in the fuselage. And shortly afterwards, the second one blew up and the plane crashed into the ocean, killing all 73 passengers and crew members. It was, at the time, the worst act of terrorism. Very quickly, the two cohorts that had been hired by Posada and Bosch confessed that they'd been hired by these guys. And the Venezuelan police arrested Posada and Bosch. Both of them got out of jail on weird reasons. I mean, Posada escaped, and I put that in quotation marks. He escaped with the help of a $50,000 bribe to the warden of the prison. And when he got out, he went to work for Colonel Oliver North, who was trying to supply the Contras, with people who have memories of those days, who were fighting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. After the Contra War ended in 1990, Posada then became a security chief for both Salvadoran and Guatemalan presidents, and then got himself shot in the cheek. Nobody knows exactly who did that, which left him with a speech impediment that people who see the film will hear. But how should I say it? In between visits to his proctologist and gerontologist, he continued conspiring. And his next job was, again, financed by the Cuban-American National Foundation, which was the heart of the anti-Castro lobby and continues essentially to act, but it's no longer the heart after the death of its patron, Jorge Mascanosa. And Posada then snuck into the United States. Now, here's a guy who was wanted for terrorism, who has admitted to the New York Times, two reporters, Ann Bardak and Larry Roeder, that he did this. And the United States government, ironically, charges him with lying on his immigration form. And part of the lying is that he said he wasn't a terrorist, and that, in fact, he was. And the jury had to think, well, if he said he was a terrorist, why aren't they charging him with terrorism? Why are they charging him with lying? Anyway, he got acquitted, and he is living in Miami, and he holds regular fundraisers in his honor, and, as I said, gets honored by a whole variety of local entities. Bosch died after getting honored at the University of Miami.
Honored and pardoned. We're speaking with Saul Landau, who made the very fine political film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? Saul, tell us about Bosch and how he got his pardon.
Well, Bosch was pardoned by President George Bush I after much work by Otto Reich, a Cuban exile who became quite important in the neoconservative movement.
He was the youngest of three brothers. They called him the Third Reich.
Yes. In Cuba, people who went to the same school as he did, which was an English-based school, called him El Mentiroso.
And what does that mean?
I leave it to the people who know Spanish to figure that out.
Let's talk about Rene Gonzalez, Saul. He's one of the Cuban Five. He's getting out of prison momentarily. He served 13 years for a crime he didn't do. He wanted to go home, and instead the judge put him on probation. You wrote an excellent article about this. Talk about the parameters and what risks he's at now.
Whether the judge did this knowingly, that is, she said he has to remain for 3 years in Miami being supervised as a condition of his parole. And did she do this because she pulled some formula out of a Justice Department manual? You know, like a narco trafficker who gets paroled can't have any association with narco traffickers or go to places that they're likely to be found. And in this case, her prescription was that he can't have any association with terrorists or go to places where terrorists are likely to go.
The irony is really thick. You know, should have issued an order to the terrorists saying you can't go near Rene.
Yes. Well, in that case, she would have had to say who they were. In the order, it doesn't say who these people are that he shouldn't associate with, nor does it say what places he shouldn't go to. So, I don't know, one lawyer friend of mine thought it was that she had pulled a formula out of some defense, some Justice Department manual, and simply stuck it in there and hadn't really even looked at it. I don't know if she's, otherwise she's stupid or cruel.
Well, it'd be funny if it wasn't so funny, because now you've got all these terrorists in Miami who are going to be gunning for a poor Rene Gonzalez who only wants to go home.
Well, essentially she's put a bullseye on his chest.
That's right.
I hope that the Justice Department has some second thoughts, or the White House, and just says, hey, let's deport this guy.
Is there anything that our listeners can do to protest this?
Yes, write to Obama, you know, saying the Troy Davis execution was enough. Now there's going to be another unofficial execution. Although Obama's getting downright trigger happy, isn't he?
We covered that on a prior segment.
After the United States assassinates a U.S. citizen abroad because it is said that he is planning terrorist acts against the United States. Now, under that precedent, would Cuba not have the same right to send assassins into Miami and gun down a whole bunch of people who are Cuban citizens in the United States who are plotting against Cuba?
Yeah.
Isn't this the precedent? I'm not a lawyer, Michael, but you are.
Well, I am, and I always thought the rule of law was a good idea. It's something that's evolved over the millennium of civilization. And to see this government tear it apart with these rationalizations so that they completely destroyed due process, which is essentially fairness, and can go assassinate somebody in a country we're not at war with who's a citizen, is really chilling.
I thought a letter in yesterday's New York Times from Peter Weiss summed it up very well, when he referred to a 1351 decision of the British court, you know, defining what this meant and still prescribing that the supposed terrorist or treason or person who committed treason still had the right to have a trial. But that was only in 1351.
Well, it was also, you know, one of the demands of the people that made the American Revolution. It's called the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution,
yes,
where you can't deprive somebody of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Thankfully, we've got people like you, Saul Landau, who make movies. Will the real terrorists please stand up, that stand up for that principle of the rule of law?
Well, people can get copies to screen if you want to screen it in theaters or places in where you live. You go to Cinema Libre Studio. They have a website. Or if you want to buy DVDs, you can get them through CinemaLibreStore.com.
Excellent.
And if you can't do that, you can get them through Amazon.com.
Saul Landau, every success with this film. We hope you sweep the Vancouver Film Festival, and we look forward to having you on Law & Disorder again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
go now to hear a wide range of voices from Zuccotti Park or Liberty Plaza, where the Occupy Wall Street protesters are encamped. Occupy Wall Street is a collective resistance movement made up of many sectors of popular opposition to the actions of this government, from pollution to war to the crushing of unions. They're calling themselves the 99%ers, who will no longer tolerate the greed and corruption of the 1%, and they're using tactics quite similar to the Arab Spring, including the use of nonviolence and civil disobedience. Our own Heidi Boghossian spoke with activists, union workers, a lawyer, and many more about where the movement is going, the support for it, and a focus on the demands, such as pushing for the redistribution of wealth from the top 1% of Americans. Let's give a listen.
We just ran into Michael Leonard, a member of the National Lawyers Guild. He's not wearing a legal observer outfit today. Rather, he's in a suit. Michael, why are you here on your lunch break?
I have been coming down here for the past week and a half or so, on and off. And I sometimes have the opportunity to work in downtown Brooklyn. And there was a mix-up with a case, so I came here on my lunch break.
So you're headed off to court after a stop here.
That's right, headed back to the ring.
And what does the sign you're carrying say?
This was a sign that I picked up up on the steps, and it says, "The crisis is capitalism," and I thought that did the trick.
Have you been talking to a lot of people here over the last 2 weeks?
Well, I've had the opportunity to talk to some people today, standing on the steps. Just get into some positive dialogue with people who are asking the protesters why they're here and what is it exactly they want.
What kind of answers are you getting to those questions, Mike?
Well, those have been questions that have been posed to me. I think that the protesters as a group, and I realize I can't really speak for them, but have been slow to articulate actual demands, and I think that in part is due to a real respect and reverence for the process and for gaining consensus among the group. I've been involved with some of this work for a number of years now, and I think that what we are seeing is a lot of grassroots bottom up decision making, and I think that's really, really wonderful.
Were you on the Brooklyn Bridge this past Saturday?
I wasn't, actually, but I was doing some legal observing here in my green hat right afterwards, and it seemed like the police were pretty agitated. And, you know, when the police get nervous, and they often lose their cool and arrest people. Fortunately, I haven't seen anyone arrested here at Liberty Square, but I know that has been a big threat, and the cops have, you know, been donning their helmets and their plastic cuffs and lining up with the orange nets sometimes, and I think that's a way of trying to menace the protesters, and it's been very confusing for some people at points. So it's been good to have legal observers down here.
Mike, I think you raise an important point. When the police officers seem to feel they're losing control, that's when we see them act perhaps beyond the boundaries of what is acceptable in terms of the Constitution. Mike, you've been to a lot of demos in New York City. Why is this one different, and in what way?
Well, I think that there is a certain tranquility here and a certain feeling of safety in numbers. Now, this obviously isn't true when the police are lining up with orange nets and they've just arrested 300 of your comrades. But there have been instances down here where I have felt a certain peacefulness, even with the amount of police that are around. And I think that, you know, when you come down to Occupy Wall Street, it is just about our presence here. And I think that our presence alone can be very, very powerful. There's obviously tons of ways to plug in, and there's people doing amazing activism within the protests, you know, who are organizing subcommittees and taking care of the day-to-day business that makes this Liberty Square run and keep it organized. But I think that there is a nice aspect of just coming down here to show your presence alone, and I think that is a very powerful thing to do a few blocks from Wall Street.
And today we have in the background Peter from Peter, Paul, and Mary singing. brings us, some of us, back to the 60s.
Any real worthwhile protest and any real worthwhile challenge to authority needs to be nurtured. And I think that our democratic consensus process is an example of how things, it takes longer time to make decisions when it's done by consensus. But the real takeaway from that is that you are nurturing a group and giving everyone a voice in this protest. And I think that that can lead to greater numbers and a more of a feeling of inclusion, and you know, just a stronger challenge and more trust and solidarity within the group.
I mean, what would be the next step once you have a lot of people like around the country, around the world, when people are together, they have a different idea? What's the next step?
Well, I think it's an iterative process. I think that the next step is going back to the tried and true methods of democracy and inclusion and consensus decision making and figuring that out as a group. But that consensus can't come out of it unless you already have the basis of trust, right?
Yeah. I sort of think you have to have a marker or some kind of a goal so people can move towards. If it's just getting together, it'll keep going. I mean, it's growing everywhere, but it's you want to think ahead a little bit, where you want to direct all this, where you want to move people's energy and into some sort of change.
Yeah, and that's really the dance, right?
But do you have politicians, corporations, they want to get in front of this? They either want to control or put themselves in front of the parade. And people are loosely organized.
Yeah. I think a lot of this is creating new, the point of this is like creating new possibilities.
Yeah,
and I think
right.
that as we do this
it
more,
opens up a new world.
And as we work together more, we do see new possibilities and new solutions. This intellectual groundswell that happens here, and the more we do it, the more we learn how
now
to do
everybody
it.
Everybody knows it's possible.
Yeah.
Then more and more people will come.
Thanks, Mike.
Concentration and patience to progress. This is the time to act as one. This is the time to unite. If we do not speak our voices, we turn a blind eye. We must be true to ourselves. Together, we will unite with our ill brothers and sisters who have been deceived and led astray. We must act as a generation for greatness. This is our opportunity now. This is the global awakening. Movements across the world, across the country, are growing and mobilizing. October 6th, we occupy the Capitol together. October 15th, the global mobilization occurs. Every city, every state comes together as one. We are the people, and we are united. And we do not accept injustice. We do not accept lies. We do not accept excuses. This is our world. This is our community. And we will make it better. That is all.
Yeah.
They told me that they used to sit here and during their breaks and play chess and checkers,
right.
And now they can't do it. So they're upset about that, and I get that. But I also, you know, I kind of get this as well,
yeah.
To a degree. You know, I have an issue when somebody's protesting against corporate America, yet they're doing it on their MacBook.
And isn't it good that this technology is at their fingertips?
I think technology is great, but I don't know if they're using it for the benefit. I don't really think they know what they're looking for. I think, I've heard a multitude of different things. I've seen a number of different signs, you know. I mean, one, you know, is a complete Pink Floyd reference to the wall.
and corporate America, and then you have, you know, other people who want to feed America. You know, I mean, I think that's great, and I think this economy, the country's gone downhill. There's plenty of people out of work and hungry. I think that's a great statement, but I don't think overall there's one concise message. I would rather see something like this happen. I've been fascinated. I've been here all day wandering around. I think it's truly the most unbelievable social experiment I've ever seen. I wish I took my children out of school to come to this. I can't wait for Monday because I'm coming back when they're off. Because, you know, but I don't know. It's incredibly well organized. Incredibly. I mean, they have free food. They have meeting times. There's something bigger behind this. It is a little bit like going to a big Further festival, though, I have to admit. They're the guys working in the World Trade Center, old former site. They're union, blue collar. They pay their benefits. They pay their rent. They pay their taxes. And yet, they're peacefully sitting there watching this. And some of them agree. It's interesting. It's a really interesting thing.
Yeah. Are you from here?
No, I live in New Jersey. I'm a Jersey housewife, but not the bad kind. I actually just met my husband for the day to have lunch with him. Well, my husband works for one of the big banks on Wall Street. And we walk through it, and he actually supports a lot of the ideas, but he does find it very funny that they take a lot of their, you know, they had shipments from Amazon. They had, you know, Poland Spring, cases of Poland Spring water sitting there, and, you know, MacBooks, telephones, etc. So, you know, they're utilizing corporate America to get the message out. I have to wonder where the money's coming from, because it's far too organized for just a sit-in protest. There's schedules, there's meetings, there's actually, I watched them today at 11 o'clock this morning, they were, the kitchen staff, which they have a free kitchen, got together and discussed what the meals were going to be for the rest of the day. It was really interesting.
What have you seen over the last 2 weeks?
Pandemonium from all these people, just crowding up the park, getting in our way. They're not really proving a point, but we understand that they're mad about maybe not having jobs, but I personally think none of these people would work if they were, had a job opportunity. I just don't think they're here for a purpose, they're here for a party.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, for the most part. I don't see them making any progress about anything. I don't hear about any. All I hear about is they're closing the crowd. Nobody's talking about anything. They're holding up signs and nobody's listening.
Some people are saying their demands aren't clear enough, that there aren't.
Who are they really bothering except pedestrians, everyday pedestrians?
They're not really getting a clear message to Wall Street. When Wall Street's down a couple blocks, they should be over there. This is not really.
They should
really
be over there blocking doorways and stuff, not
going in a public
not
park.
Crowding the park.
Have you seen deliveries coming in the early morning, food and water?
Well, they're definitely getting deliveries. I don't know what time, though.
Yeah, I haven't seen them yet.
Because this place has been growing rapidly, daily. And it's in the morning when you see it. I come out here for lunch. We used to sit down at benches here. We're to a nice, clean, beautiful park.
It should be all and construction now, workers just for the time.
It's
here.
Just,
it's like a shanty town.
What do you think should be done, though, to protest what's happening with the economy?
Well, for our sakes, we're in the union, so we do our own rallies, and we go and we make a message across. We're talking, and we're getting chants going, so it's pretty obvious what we're getting across. These people are playing drums, and it's just like a hippie convention for the most part. It really doesn't seem like any of these people are really trying to get a clear message across to anyone in Wall Street or...
I have a feeling if you talk to half of them, they don't even know why they're here.
But a lot of the unions are supporting this effort, aren't they?
There are. Don't get me wrong.
I support that they're standing for a cause. And that cause would be jobs. I just think they're going about it the wrong way. All I see is they're crowding a park. And go to the powers that be. They're not talking to anybody over here. Go stand on Bloomberg's front steps or something. Go set up a tent in front of his house.
Well, they did that in the summer, remember?
I guarantee more would get done. All they're doing is crowding the park here.
But they could learn a lot from labor organizing.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom, I just wanted to be part of the movement. I think the banks and the financial institutions have really raped America. And I think to focus this, we're really after getting the restoration of Glass-Steagall restored. That was started in 1933 as a result of the Great Depression. Then they eroded that over the years, and it seems like we're back in the same fix. Is that interfered with corporate profits, of course, so they got rid of Glass-Steagall. So I think we want to focus on one item besides complaining about the Wall Street and so forth, is to restore that good act.
And you, are you from New York?
No, I'm from New Jersey. I was just telling the lady that we finally bought a house, and then due to this terrible mortgage debacle, which was a wholesale robbery, our home has lost about $30,000 in the last 5 years. So it's not just the poor and the homeless who have gotten a beating. The loss of the value of the house, and we're kind of underwater now. We still have to pay for the house. That was a value originally assessed at about $350,000, and now it's about $260,000, so it was kind of a big hit. My wife and I are kind of freelancers, and there's just not as much happening to go there.
What did you expect to see down here?
I thought it would be something like this, maybe a little more noisier, more organized as far as marching by Wall Street, or a little more focused in our demands, because now it's kind of looking a little bit ragtag. And I think we need a couple leaders either giving speeches or rallying people.
I'm from Western New York. I've been here on and off for about 10 days. And were you on the Brooklyn Bridge? Yes, I was. I was arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Did you feel that the police were literally leading you onto the bridge? Yes. You know, there's been questions of whether or not they made an actual announcement of, you know, if you go on the Brooklyn Bridge, that you would get arrested. I heard no such announcement. However, I did talk to people who said that the announcement was made on a very, very muffled bullhorn so that they could have it on film that they said it, but that it was not audible even to the people standing right in front of them.
Have you been in other arrest situations, and how did this compare in terms of police treatment of protesters?
I've been arrested for other protest-related things, not in New York City. As I said, I'm from Western New York. However, this was not good, but not bad. I feel that, you know, being cuffed on an MTA bus for 6 hours with no food and no water isn't the best treatment, but I was in no way, like, physically harmed directly by the cops. I do feel like I have a little bone bruising on my wrists from the flexi cuffs, but, you know, I know it could be a lot worse. There were other arrests earlier in this occupation where people had, you know, concussions and were not treated well and left on buses and were not able to get medical treatment. So in that way, I feel very lucky that I was not treated as those occupiers were treated. But at the same time, not being able to eat, not having access to water, except for whatever was in our backpacks, is still not very acceptable, in my opinion. We're humans too, you know, whether or not the state or the government agrees with us, we deserve to be treated like humans.
Are you surprised at how this movement is catching on all around the country?
Yes and no, because I am surprised because, you know, of the diversity of people that have been coming out and saying, I'm very particularly far left personally, and was concerned it would be a group of far leftists that would be construed as, you know, another anarchist, militant, violent group of people. However, it has been pleasantly surprising to me the number of people that have come out that are liberal, that are, you know, libertarian, and maybe even conservative, but we all share the same views. We are all the 99%, and we all have very common goals. What really separates, you know, the extreme right from the extreme left, in my opinion, is mostly tactics. And the dispute comes not from the end goal. It's how do we get to that end goal?
Process.
Yeah, process, definitely.
Any final words for people who might be thinking of coming here from around the country?
You know, come out and see what we're all about. Give it a shot. I came out here only intending to spend a week, and I am back indefinitely because this this is a beautiful movement. You know, I would encourage anyone who has any inkling and any, you know, financial resources to get out here to come and do it, even if they can only do it for a weekend, even if they can only come out for one day to do it, because it's a beautiful scenario. And, you know, for those who can't come, you know, we have ways that you can contribute to donations. We have our live stream. We have other ways that you can contribute. Being here in person is not the only way that you can support Occupy Wall Street.
My name is Dig App. Karen.
And you're helping raise money here to feed people.
Yeah, for people who have gluten-free, who can't eat wheat or stuff like that. Most of the food we've been getting in contains that. We have been getting some stuff like rice and lentils and beans and stuff, so it's been okay, but we're trying to raise money for food. I'm just doing this for a little bit here today.
Are you getting a lot of food donations from people?
Yeah, we have been, totally. We've also been getting cash donations, so we order pizza and buy our own food, but definitely the community around us, from everywhere from like restaurants to like little old ladies cooking in their own kitchen, have been bringing in food for us.
They literally come by and bring the food.
Yeah. Trays, totally.
Like what?
I don't know. Lots of stuff I can't eat but want to, like lasagna. Good rice and curries and stuff, yeah.
And does the food demand rise on the weekends?
I don't know. It's always pretty busy. It has been since I've been here. Yeah. The last 5 days.
Where are you from?
I'm from Canada. From British Columbia, actually.
You're from Canada. Why is this important to you?
Because our democracy, our government, our policies follow pretty closely in the footsteps of our neighbors, I guess. Yeah, it's pretty much the same system we live under, even though some minor technical differences. But I don't know.
And where do you sleep here at night?
I have a little bivy sack over there in Safer Spaces. Keeps me dry and covers my sleeping bag. So the other night when it rained, I think it was maybe Saturday night or something, or Friday night, it was, we had lots of plastic sheets. A lot of people didn't sleep, I don't think, they just stood around. We had tarps and stuff though, so I don't know. Some people just slept in the rain, I guess, got wet.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
We'll be right back.